This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, what a week this past week has been. I went to Las Vegas and had just a wonderful time. I was with my older son, Sean, kind of recreating his birthday. We had a long birthday week. His birthday was actually October the 2nd, and he was 43 years old. But on his 21st birthday, I had taken him out to Las Vegas to see some of the shows, and now we kind of recreated some of those moments, but on a different level this time. It was so much fun, and in part why we went this week was to share the joy with my good buddy, Murray Sawchuk, who was getting married to Danny Elizabeth, and they had a marvelous ceremony. In fact, it was Johnny Katz, who is a journalist there in Las Vegas on the entertainment scene for the newspaper, had remarked that this was the wedding of the year. If you haven't seen this all over the social media, it was every place, so it was great. Anyhow, a lot of fun. So we were there for that wedding. I can go on and on about that, but just check it out. Some of the photos and places and things that I had posted on my Facebook page and on Instagram. But aside from that, later that week, I got to share the stage with Murray there at the Laugh Factory in the Tropicana and doing 9 minutes as part of his show. So that was really nice that he gave me a little stage time there to check off my bucket list of actually I've performed in Las Vegas several occasions, but it's always been private parties for corporate events or trade shows or things, but nothing really for the public like that. So it was really kind of a special thing. Had an opportunity to go and do that. Throughout the week, had a great time. One of the things I did while I was there, I got to see Banachek show and visit with him, had breakfast one morning, but I was having breakfast with Stan Allen, and he was the one who had suggested, perhaps, that I add a few things on the beginning of the podcast, like I'm doing here this week, and that is perhaps some current events. And if you guys like that, I will try to continue with this to give you a few updates on what's happening today as it happens for this week in Magic, if you will. He used to do that many years ago before he had Magic Magazine, when he still had a newsletter. But anyhow, I thought it was a pretty good idea. And if you guys like it, again, let me know. You can drop me an email, scott@themagicwordpodcast.com, and just say, hey, I like it, or I don't, or it's too long, or too short, or whatever. Or I'd rather have this at the end of the podcast rather than the beginning of the podcast. But I want to thank Stan for the suggestion. And also, one of the things that was important that did happen this last week, and that is the FISM North American team has been selected. They were in Quebec City up in Canada, and we can announce that the winners for that, for the close-up, who will be actually part of that North American team, coming in first place was Simon Cornell. Also on the team will be Shane Cobalt, Yannick LaCroix, Shudagawa, Ed Ripley, and Eric Tate. Congratulations, guys. That's phenomenal, and good luck to you then next year. On stage, Stuart McDonald took the top honors. Also on the stage team will be Nicholas Dutel, or Doodle, I'm not sure, D-U-T-E-L, and Elliot Hunter. Congratulations to you guys also. So that is our FISM North American team for next year, and they'll be competing in the FISM Championships in July in 2022 in Quebec City in Canada. So I'll be there at FISM and watching that, but I couldn't be two places at the same time, so I'm glad I had Dal Sanders, who was up there and keeping track of everything. And another big announcement this week is that we're going to be having the North American Championships in Dallas, Texas, as part of FISM. That will be happening, I believe, in 2024. So stay tuned to that. There'll be more details on that later, too. So a lot of stuff that really happened this last week in Magic, and I just thought I would kind of give you a quick update. There are some other things probably, too, that have been happening, but this particular podcast this week, my guest, Mr. Joseph Gabriel, our conversation we had was a little bit longer than our typical 1 hour or so. So hang with this. I think I know you'll love it for sure. I was in Las Vegas about a month ago for the Collectors Expo and got a chance for him to come to the room. We sat down for a while and had a delightful conversation. We've been trying to get together over the phone or Skype or something for, oh golly, almost a year, it seems like, and we haven't been able to do that until recently. So this is just a wonderful opportunity for you to hear from someone who worked with Ricciardi. I've had hundreds, if not thousands of shows in Las Vegas, has toured the world, has a great bird act, and he also, I didn't know it until the end, he has also does a marionette, and he also is an artist and has a lot of prints that he has been making, and as well as the marionettes he had carved and everything. So he is quite an artist. He'd worked at Tannen's for a while. This is all going to be explained, and you will find the multifaceted magician here this week that will astound you, not just with the bird act that he has done all over the world and received so many accolades and been on Johnny Carson and it's magic show. Anyhow, I'm going to let him tell the story. I'm going to shut up now. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Joseph Gabriel, here on The Magic Word. We are now in the great city of Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'm here with someone who is, I think, one of the icons of magic in general, not just a Las Vegas guy that I think of, but also someone who is a tremendous performer. It's been around for a while, and a name you should be familiar with. And if you're not, you're going to meet a new friend here today in Joseph Gabriel. Joseph, can I call you Joey? What do they call you? What are
people? Only East Coast. Growing up on the East Coast, I'm from New Jersey originally.
Yeah.
But everybody in New Jersey and New York, Joey, hey, Paul, you know, everyone's yeah. Paulie, Vinny, Joey, yeah. How you doing? So, yeah, I'm used to it. But because I chose to use Joseph more formal.
Stage name. Yeah,
Joseph Gabriel. Folks always call me Joseph simply because that's what they see all the time. They assume.
That's right.
But all my East Coast buddies and, you know. Still, Joey, how you doing?
I had heard someone yesterday talk to you, and they were calling you Joey, and I thought, well, okay, I wonder if he prefers to go by that, you know,
no.
just, or if
no,
you just
it makes
Joseph.
A difference. Hey, you, you know.
You answer, okay, you turn around.
Hey, get out of here, you know, that's all of those I kind of obey.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you did move from New Jersey, and you've been in Vegas.
You know, it's an...
You had a circuitous journey, I know.
That was an odd journey, too. I had simply, as a lot of us growing up, were a big fan of Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. We knew Johnny, or staff chose one person from the It's Magic Show every year in California. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a kid. I'm in my late teens, and I'm working on my magic act. What most people know my magic act to be. There was I was 16 years old, about to do the night before party at the Tannen's Jubilee. For those
in Kutchner's?
Tannen's.
Oh, in Tannen's, yeah. But
Tony Spina had.
But didn't they have the Jubilee at Kutchner's?
No, no. It was Poconos in the Browns Hotel.
Browns, that's what it was.
In the Catskills.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the night before party was on Thursday. Night before party is folks who arrive because the convention actually starts the next day on Friday. So you, if Tony Spina wanted to test you out, he put you on the night before party. So that's the first time I actually...
And if you work out, then they put you on a later show.
You graduate to the Friday night, I think, and then and further and further. In any event... So I was going to perform the night before party. I'm 17. But when I was 16, my dad used his 8mm camera. How is this for technology nowadays? But yeah, basically that 16mm film of my act looks virtually the same, except I'm simply better doing it now. So I hope 30 years later. And it was no parrots or, you know, I didn't have any of that kind of stuff.
No birds, no livestock?
Well, birds, yes, but no parrots. No big, giant parrots. I couldn't afford them. I was a kid.
Yeah.
Know,
Are they quite expensive?
Well, when I never paid more than like $1,200 for a parrot, a macaw.
Yeah. And they live for like 30 years.
70 to 100.
70 to, I did not know that.
So they'll do the act without me.
I was going to say, like, after you're gone, do you
leave room for the laughs there, Scott, okay?
Pause.
Because the people at home.
One, two. Okay. Dick. Yeah.
Now they're the last time I priced them, $3,600. And I'm like, geez.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and you know, I mean, I don't mind, you know, cooking them and eating them, but that's an awful expensive meal.
expensive dinner. Now, when I think what was phenomenal, again, I wanted to talk about some things, but not necessarily to rehash what you had talked about, Ricciardi, during the Collector's Corner, because that was something that David Sandy and Lance Richard put together, and they had a Ricciardi evening and everything. But I do want to talk about that a little bit. You went into a lot of great detail about some things in working with Ricciardi and his son and the family and everybody. You keep in contact, I guess, with some of these people.
Yes, of course. They're part of my growing up, but my journey starting in New Jersey, I realized Johnny Carson was not going to come to New Jersey to see me. I had to go to where Johnny was, and that's why I decided.
Well, he was in New York for a while, and then he went to California. Vice versa.
But he was in California. You know, I was way decades before I went out to California.
Okay.
And so that's when I was working with Ricciardi's show, and I was with Ricciardi's show over a 2-year period, probably close to a year of bookings, because there were spaces in between the different bookings we did.
Yeah.
We did like 8 months in Atlantic City, 5 weeks in South Africa, Johannesburg, pre-apartheid. I should say before apartheid fell. That was amazing. But Florida condominium circuits. But the thing that made the difference was getting booked at the Felt Forum in Madison Square Garden. The Felt Forum, called the Little Theater, holds 5,000 people.
That was the Little Theater.
The Little Theater, okay. Yes. And they would curtain it off for shows, so it would be half that, 2,000 or 2,500 people. And it was there that Peter Pitt saw me. And then Peter Pitt said, hey, if you ever have a free week, come out and do the Magic Castle. Well,
back when it was big pay.
There you go. Back when you got $500 a week.
That's
and
right.
Had to find your own,
and find your own place.
Hotel.
That's right.
And your own food.
Yeah.
And I went, I have to save up to work the Magic
That's
Castle.
That's the deal.
Yeah. So, which all of us joke about still.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
But literally 4 months later, 3 months later, I called Peter Pitt and said, okay. And he goes, how's February? Which was 4 months after the Christmas show at the Felt Forum. And I found myself doing my first week at the Magic Castle, first time ever. And met all of the people I had only read about in Genie Magazine.
Yeah.
Norm Nielsen.
All your heroes. Just kind of,
yes,
there they
Norm Nielsen, Marvin Roy, the Larson family, everybody in the Larson family.
Did they see you and like you and want to put you, then want to put you in the It's Magic show right away?
Saw me, liked me. Which was lovely, but I owe two people a great debt of gratitude for helping boost and help continue my career in L.A., and that was the then president of the Magic Castle, Ron Wilson, and amazing actor, sleight-of-hand artist, close-up magician, who everyone got killed in the Godfather movies, and in Clint Eastwood movies, Tony Giorgio.
Oh, yeah.
Great actor. And both of them, my opening at the Magic Castle, kidnapped me and brought me to the Body Shop. Body Shop strip club on La Cienega and Sunset Boulevard.
I got a funny story about that, too.
Yes,
myself,
it's hilarious. Yeah. And where the marquee had outlines of shapely women.
Silhouettes, yeah.
Yes, there you go. And they take me, and I'm looking at a place, and I'm going, what a dive. What is this? And it's still, but it's LaRound years later.
Yeah.
But what I found was, as they drove me over there, Shimada's worked here, Norm Nielsen's worked here, the Pendragons, it was like
kind of a who's who of a magician.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's the word I was looking for. And I went, okay, so I go in there and I walk in, and on stage as I walked in was Kitten Natividad. Kitten Natividad was in a giant martini glass taking a bath on stage. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh. And what I found out was Jamal, who owned the club, loved lovely ladies and magicians, and he was a member of the Magic Castle. And when I heard the list of magicians who would work there, I went, okay, whatever. They both of these, Tony Giorgio and Ron Wilson, introduced me to Jamal, and they're saying, book this guy, don't even go see him at the castle, he's there all week,
but take
book
our advice.
This guy now, don't hesitate. And he literally pulls out a contract and says, okay.
Right there.
Took their right word there for it. And says, okay, let's see what you got. Now I'm like, what, huh? I know nothing about anything. And And he says, I'll come see you Wednesday. So this was a Monday, because you start on a Monday at the Magic Castle.
Right, right.
And then he comes to see me, and he says, please come to the office. And then but he literally wanted to sign me that Monday with on their word alone, mm-hmm. which was very sweet.
Well, and usually it's after. In other words, if you work the early, well, I say early, you're working the palace, and so you're probably working until midnight, so it'd be...
Well, what happened was I was working at the castle in February. And he booked me 2 months later to start, because you only work a week at the castle.
Yeah.
2 months later in April is when I started. April of 83 is when I began working at the body shop. And I believe I have the distinction of working there the longest five and a half months.
Months? Oh, yeah. My goodness.
And what it did was, first of all, you got a crash course in what it's like to be in show business. Jamal said, as I was signing my contract, I'm preparing you for Vegas. What, you're going to take my money?
You're about how, yeah, that's right. That's a good
You're going
one.
To rob me now?
Now, how old were you at the time?
Let me see here. I had just turned
21, I guess.
24, okay. 3, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And so I went, okay. No, I must have been 20, must have been 23. And I know exactly why. So I start working there, and literally that stops. Norm was kind of dangling the possibility of It's Magic in front of me, mm-hmm. But nothing confirmed. And I finished working at the body shop and was like, okay, now what? And buddies I had gotten to know simply mentioned, hey, are you familiar with the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach? Yeah. Mike Lacey still owns it. I'm shocked, and I've got to give Mike a call. If Mike's listening, I love you. Mike Lacey has the Comedy Magic Club. One magician works at the Comedy Magic Club. Mm-hmm. The rest, obviously, with the giant word comedy at the top, is mostly comedy. And you're working with... one headliner comedian who is a known comedian who's done...
Like Robin Williams or somebody.
Exactly, right. You know, Jay Leno worked there. All the greats, everyone you can mention who's a named comedian has worked there.
Yeah.
And all of the rest of the guys are guys who had gotten a spot or are up-and-comers, and then he throws a magician in just for fun. My opening night there, it was wild because I'm... You know, it's community dressing room. So mm-hmm. here I've got my chickens, and I'm, you know, rolling handkerchiefs and doing stuff, and all the comedians are...
And you're working with parrots at the time?
No, not yet. Wait a minute. Let me see here. No, I don't think... Yes, I did. Yes, I had a parrot. So I'm trying to keep my parrot quiet, and these guys are just... When you have a group of comedians, all they do is make fun of each other.
I would imagine.
They rib each other, they and at times it's brutal.
In the dressing room.
Yes,
yeah.
It's brutal. And it's like a locker room gone crazy, but no, it's hilarious and funny. And they're watching me set up my act, because when you're in a situation like that, you can't care.
Yeah.
You know, they're worried about doing their jokes. They're worried. They're all starting to pace as it gets closer.
They don't care about putting a dove in a harness and whatever.
No, could care less. They don't care. They may watch during the course of the week.
Yeah.
But they're not. And during the course of the week, they said, I know where they're hidden because I've seen you, what you've done.
Them.
But when I watch your act, I have no idea how you're getting them from A to B.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, good.
Thanks.
Just like, I don't know why the audience likes you either.
Good one. Yeah.
So it was the week I was there, Bob Saget was the headliner before Full House.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this is early 80s.
Was he playing blue back then? Do you remember?
A little bit. Okay. He seems to be more now.
Yeah, he does now.
More now. Yeah. But, I think he was just beginning to realize that sometimes blue material worked.
Yeah.
In any event, it was a very good opening. It was a Monday again. I get a standing ovation, which I was like, wow, this is crazy. But everyone's there. They're having a great time. They're drinking like crazy. It's a comedy club. All the comedians... Larry Miller, all of these name people who have become names during the course of the 80s were there. And I'm like, Kirkenbauers, there was another one, I think. Amazing, talented people. And but they hadn't become known yet, like myself.
Mm-hmm.
They became nationally known. I became magician-y known.
Okay. right.
And I get a message from one of the waitresses, Mike Lacey would like to see you in the office after the show. Now, when you hear that, you don't think, I'm going to give you a raise.
Yeah. I'm out of here. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking, I just did my one night only.
Yeah.
And he says, Hey, it's good to have you here, but what's going on? I said, I'm sorry, what's the... Well, magicians don't get standing ovations here.
Do I need to tell him to sit down?
Or? I'm sorry. I thought that was my goal.
Yeah.
And he goes, and then he smiles and says, no, you did fantastic.
Yeah.
It's amazing that on an opening night that that would happen on a Monday. Uh-huh. Usually the crowds are much better as it gets towards the weekend, but
sure.
Wow. Very impressive. Have the Tonight Show people seen you yet? No, tonight, I don't know. I'm months in L.A.
Yeah.
And he says they will. Days later, on a Wednesday night, Jim McCauley, who was the talent scout for comedians and for variety acts, comes to see the show. Mike Lacy comes back and says, Jim's in the audience. Okay. I do my act, get a nice reaction from the audience. After the show, Jim comes to me and says, when are you available?
Wow, just like that.
Yes, and that's exactly what I said to him. Wow, just like that. I said, "There's no angels from heaven. There's no marching band." He goes, "No, it's just that." It's just that simple.
Yeah.
And he goes, "You're great. Johnny will love you, and you're great. You're good enough to be on the show. There's no question."
Yeah.
I was like, "Wow." And when are you available? And he gives me a date, and it's in October, and I'm like, you're walking on air. It's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I went, wow. And then the week finishes. He calls me like a week or two later and says, we're going to have to cancel your date. And my heart just.
Yeah.
And we have another date for you on November 3rd. Don't do that to me, Jim. Don't do that. And then he laughs.
Yeah.
Like, it's a gag. Yeah. And I'm going, yeah, then that's why you're a talent scout. You're killing me. And he goes, yeah, I know, but it's fun. It's fun. No, for you.
Yeah.
November 3rd is my birthday.
Oh, wow.
And I went, what a great birthday present. So literally for me, I wind up going to L.A. in February. I start working at the comedy, the Body Shop in April. And like by the time I arrived in LA, 7 months later, I'm on The Tonight Show with Johnny, and it was fantastic. And that is a lovely experience in itself. And 4 months later, I find myself at the Lido de Paris in Las Vegas at the Stardust Hotel. So I often tell folks, watch out what you wish for.
Yeah,
because it just may come true.
I always say you should also not only have dreams but have plans, because you may achieve your goals if you do follow a plan, and you'll get that sooner. Yeah. If you just kind of go anywhere and you bounce around, you may achieve a goal, achieve something that you wanted to do, but you need to actually go for it. And that's something in which it sounds like that you wanted to do, and you got to it a lot faster than you expected.
So to a great degree, a lot of the time, in the acts that are booked to do the It's Magic Show, one of them is chosen, John Shrum, who was the set designer for The Tonight Show, would sort of sit in on rehearsals and tell Johnny who the up-and-coming, and Johnny loves manipulation, so he would tell Johnny who the manipulators are or whoever, you know, whatever, this guy is the one we should get, and that helps plug for Bill Milt Larson, and Milt Larson plug the It's Magic Show for tickets.
Was John Shrum actually kind of going to the Magic Castle and seeing all the acts, and so that's why he kind of had his finger on the pulse?
Because he's involved, he was involved with the set design of the Tonight Show, and then was very good friends of Milt and Bill Larson.
Okay. So Milt and Bill were whispering in his ear also.
Yeah, it seemed to be the go-between. He
seemed
to be the go-between.
Okay.
And I'm sure if they needed to have Jim McCauley come see
to confirm that
I already done the Tonight Show. So for Milt, it was kind of funny when I get summoned to Milt's office, it was, well, you've already done the Tonight. You know, you're already. So it was kind of, it was fun. I was already booked because I think I was already booked to do the Tonight Show November 3rd, and the It's Magic Show was before my birthday or something like this or whatever. Or
now, back during the Johnny Carson show, that was when he had such an audience, and if you appeared on there, a lot of times people I've talked to who have said, after I appeared, I got this job or this opportunity.
My phone is ringing off the hook literally the next day.
That's what I was wondering. Was it?
I was also recognized in the street the very next day. I go to the market, open market on Fairfax, was it? And yeah, I'm recognized. And it's funny because it wasn't like back in the day when it was like the Ed Sullivan Show, where there's only three channels. And everyone on Earth was, well, everyone in America who had television was watching the Ed Sullivan. So Jay Marshall told me that about doing the, literally he got recognized everywhere from because he's, everyone's watching me as well. But I was kind of amazed. And it just made me be aware of the power of television.
Did you turn things over to an agent? I mean, they're contacting...
I would have loved to have found a nice, powerful agent that said, hey, young man.
Let me handle you.
Let me... Yes, exactly right. But no, it didn't happen.
So people were calling you directly the next day?
Yes.
Wow. And so how could you sort that all out to say, well, I want to do this or that? Or I had, you already had contracts to do something?
A few things came up, but what happened... And it's and the reason I'm stumbling here is because over the years, a lot of young guys have come to me asking me advice of how do I get to be booked in Vegas? How do I get to be well known amongst the magic community? Blah blah blah. And it's all lovely and wonderful what happened to me, but what I've told them is it's similar to being an artist. In that you give canvas and brush and paints to an artist, and they all will create something different. You'll get 100 artists. It'll be something different that winds up as the end result. Mm-hmm. I said you can talk to 100 performers who have worked in Vegas, magicians and otherwise, jugglers and whoever, and all of their stories will be completely different. There is no formula.
Right.
The only thing I knew sitting in New Jersey was if one of my goals was to work the Magic Castle and one of my goals was to be on The Tonight Show with Johnny, I had to go to California. They weren't coming to see me. I mean, yes, of course, Peter Pitt just happened to be in New York to do something, and he happened to come see Ricciardi's show that I happened to be in.
Yeah.
All of those blocks had to be, you know...
The dominoes are lined
up. Yes, exactly right, in order for it to happen. But there's no formula, and I said, Steve Martin has a great line. Be so good they can't ignore you.
Oh, I've heard that before.
Yes,
that is
it's,
good.
It's fantastic, and that's exactly true. You have to be as you know, opportunity meets you know, persistence or whatever. There's the countless self-help slogans you can read or learn, but it's true. You have when the opportunity comes, you have to be ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
And to a great degree, I would tell these young guys, I don't believe I was ready to do my first Tonight Show spot.
Yeah.
I felt I had something unique I had created in my Dove act. You know, the thought process was I didn't want one Dove where I bunched up a silk into a ball and had a Dove climb out of it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I felt great when I get a one of the ushers comes backstage when I was at the Flamingo in City Lights and says, there's a gentleman in the audience who wants to see you at the show. His name is Channing Pollock.
Wow.
Wow. And I went, oh, my God. And when Channing first sees me, the first word out of his mouth is, I love your act because you don't do me.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, it really sank in. He loved the fact that I took it. I'm in tails. Yeah, I'm producing White Doves, but I'm not doing his style and not doing his technique. Not that there's anything wrong with it. It's gorgeous when it's done. I could watch Channing now and just go, oh, my God, it's just brilliant.
But his style was different from Cantu.
Correct.
You know?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And then I watched Shamata in, I think, 75 on The Tonight Show. And that was, I believe, Shamata was the first person I ever saw do an Instant Dove production on the cane when he would have a handkerchief. You're expecting a dove of a handkerchief, change it to a cane, and then a dove instantly appears on the cane.
Right.
And again, you meet your masters. I'll share the story. I'm privileged enough to be asked by Mel Larson to do the It's Magic show. Mm-hmm. Opening night, I'm on the bill with Senior Wences. How amazing is that?
I saw that show.
Yes.
I was working the castle.
Oh, there you go.
That week doing close-up because Senior Wences came in to see me perform. And I remember they had a reception also for Senior Wences.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yes.
Okay.
He was in his 80s.
I wonder if that's when we first met.
But amazing.
But anyhow, yeah.
But and as much as we may have seen him on television, to see it live, there's something about...
Yes.
It's, oh my God, just brilliant. All right. I mean, and then all of that stuff that we take for granted, you go, here's the guy.
That's right.
This is the one. This is the guy that, all right.
Started it
all. That's the source.
Yeah.
Just fantastic. And I love the fact that at the time, his female manager or agent, Simone Finner in L.A., I'm rehearsing my act at the It's Magic show. It's in a lovely aside. And I felt like, oh, yay, I'm at the It's Magic show.
Sure.
I'm rehearsing on stage at the Variety Arts Theater, which is gorgeous.
Yeah.
And Senior Wentz is rehearsing next. And I'm finishing up my rehearsal. And I hear from in the audience, Joseph, will you get off the stage? Senior Wentz wants to rehearse. Thank you, Simone. I love you, too. I'm leaving. Thanks. Bye. Master, please come forward. It's like certain things as you go through your life, or at least for me in my show business career, you're blessed. You feel like you're on cloud nine, and then something like that happens, and it just brings you right back down to being humble. And,
humble again, yes.
Yeah, you can't get a big head because someone's there with a not a pin, a machete.
Yeah.
Chop. Anyway, I got off on a tangent.
Well, when you were working with Ricciardi,
you
were performing then, too, didn't you? I mean, as part of like a variety. You weren't like not an assistant or a lead man. Or...
Yeah, I was doing my Bird Act in and around New York, and again, when young guys ask me, I said, perform at magic conventions. Go do an IBM show. Do an SAM show.
Compete also.
Oh, what? You're getting paid $100 or they're giving you gas money?
Yeah.
Okay.
Take it.
Go. Yeah. But do the show.
Go work the Lions Club. Work fraternal luncheons.
Just speaking
chicken dinners.
At the convention, I was just speaking to a young man who just began. He loves card magic, and he just began, a year ago or whatever. He's 15 or whatever. And I said, do shows for free. Mm-hmm. The main thing you have to do.
Flight time.
Yes, exactly right. You have to get time in front of people. As much as in your brain as you think, because we have met them all, these young guys who think, I'm not talking young guys who are known, these young guys who think they know everything because they know how to do two card tricks. Mm-hmm. To videotape yourself, now that privilege is available to everyone, when you're performing, so that you see yourself as that, and you look at it as if it's someone else, mm-hmm. and you can rip it to shreds, which I often do, even watching me, because it's so helpful to see. You can watch that performer and judge what you think should be changed in what you're watching. It's that simple.
Sure.
But I said, it's more than card tricks. It's performing. It's your personality. It's being funny, if that's what you want to do. Whatever character you want to bring to this, you can. Mm-hmm. But it's also your personality that's going to make it different. Doing card tricks that everyone else is doing is fine, but it's not going to get you anywhere. You're just going to be one of the many. Yeah, so
you're not going to stand out.
That's correct.
Going back to what Steve Martin was saying.
Yeah, exactly, you know, right.
Too.
Yeah.
Wow, interesting. Well, you had...
But you mentioned Ricciardi.
Yes.
So I'm in and around New Jersey, New York, doing SAM shows and IBM shows and doing whatever shows make him up. And all of a sudden, I'm at Tannen's.
Yeah.
And I illustrated Tannen's topics, started, like, I think I was a junior in high school. Again, it was luck. I happened to be in the Tannen showroom when Tony Spina came out to talk to his then partner, Jack Ferrero, and said, hey, I'm looking for another artist. We got to find another artist for Tannen's Topics. Somebody had stopped working. I'd gotten a gig, and they were too busy. And I think I was like a junior in high school and happened to be with my mom at Tannen's, because driving in and around New York was, for lots of folks, is hellish nightmare, trying to get parking or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think my parents had driven me in. And my dad was downstairs, like, looping around the block or trying to get a parking space.
Right.
And my mom happened to – I was – again, I'm a junior in high school. I'm a kid. I'm a middle teen. And she says, well, you know, my son draws. What? Mm-hmm. Yeah, my son draws. Kid? You know, kid, bring your portfolio and show me your stuff.
Yeah.
And literally the next day, I took the bus into the city and showed him my stuff. And I goes, okay. And I started, you know,
like, when could you start?
$10 a drawing, and I started illustrating for Tannen's Topics, and I did that for years. Helped me get through high school, pay for high school stuff, and helped me do stuff through college. I then started illustrating.
Did you study art in college?
Yeah, I was doing art since I was born. My mom sent me, like, a few years ago sent me drawings I did in kindergarten.
Wow.
That she had kept for forever. Hmm. The 500 years I've been here. And and so that's why at the you know, I started when the pandemic hit, I started doing my art again. Uh-huh. But so I'm working at Tannen's and doing stuff, but I'm delivering drawings to Tony Spina, and I hear through the grapevine, Ricciardi's looking for another act. Ricciardi, who's that? Yeah. Oh, he's I had never heard of him. And he's performing at the Village Gate Theater or like right down the block. Really? Go see the show. You're insane. You should go see the show. Yeah. Oh, okay. I guess I'm insane. I go see the show. I'm blown away. Mm-hmm. I'm blown.
Never seen anything like that.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the illusions, sure, I've seen. But this guy comes on stage and he, who would, in your brain as a magician, would you think, I'm going to open with rice bowls.
Okay.
You know, I mean, really.
Yeah.
But he comes on stage first thing, and it's funny, when the very first time I ever saw Wayne Newton in Vegas years ago.
Singing Tiny Bubbles?
All of that, yeah. and Don Kershon and all of his famous, you know, all of the tunes. It was the same experience when Ricciardi comes on stage. There's this energy from this man that I had not seen before in a performer, mm-hmm. not a magician performer, but I relate it to Wayne Newton, because when Wayne Newton comes on stage, you are very aware that, one, this is the guy who everyone here is here to see.
Yes.
He's the star, or whatever that star quality is.
Yes, sir.
He's got it.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's got it.
Yes, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. He's the one that you find compelled to look at with all the other humans on stage. That's the guy. And it could be a woman. You know, I'm not saying Wayne Newton could be a woman. I'm just saying.
I understand.
You know what I mean? If that's the lead or whatever. He is dressed like his tux was airbrushed on him. He mm-hmm. looks impeccable. He looks, and the same thing again, decades later with Ricciardi. He comes on in his bolero, and he looks like a million
matador.
Bucks.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like a matador. There's something about his personal energy, the way he looks, the way he moves. Everything about him is, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This is the person to see. The power
you
of
can
whatever
take your eyes
that
off
is.
Of him.
What's that?
You can't take your eyes off
Correct.
Of him.
Correct. Yeah. Whatever that power is, he's got it, and your mouth is agape watching this guy.
Yeah.
And then he does rice and water. He does a transposition effect of rice going from one side of the stage to the other using rice bowls and some magic-y canister. He finishes. The audience erupts in, like, violent applause for this man.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there going, wow. Now, I guarantee you some of the audience were saying to themselves, what just happened? What did he do? What happened?
Yeah.
I saw rice and I saw water, and now I'm seeing rice and water again. And I guarantee you some of the people didn't realize that, yeah, the rice was on the left and now it's on the right, and the water.
Because they were watching the play.
But oh, my God.
It was unfolding.
He's out. There's four assistants. There's tables being moved. He's hurtling props over his head. They're catching them behind him.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's like, and it's nonstop. And then out comes the Temple of Benares, and he's shoving, and the girl gets in, and he's shoving swords in her, and all of this 10 minutes of intense performance power.
Yeah.
All choreographed to the T, and boom, and it's like, geez. And it's almost like the only thing I could relate it to is like a Bruce Springsteen or an Elvis coming out on stage and doing three tunes in a row and blowing the audience away, and they're left like literally reeling back going, oh my God, what did I just see? Yeah. It had that power.
Uh-huh.
And again, years later, Wayne Newton, when I come to Vegas, is this name person. I've, of course, heard of Wayne Newton before coming here, but I'd never seen him perform. Mm-hmm. And now I'm watching him. And now I'm understanding, oh, why does this man have this name? Or now, I'm sure if I had seen him decades earlier, he would have had more of that, whatever that is, because now he's an older gentleman. Mm-hmm. But still, it's all there. There's no question.
Well, I saw Sammy Davis Jr. here in Vegas.
God bless you, yeah.
So I know what that experience is like.
Sammy Davis has a personal soft spot in my heart simply because of two reasons. When my parents were married and went to Florida on their honeymoon, that's who they saw live.
Oh, wow.
And my mom would rave about him. She's 91 now and still raves about him. Mm-hmm. The most dynamic performer she said she's ever seen. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing. I, living in this crazy town for years, a lot of the supermarkets used to be open 24 hours.
Okay.
I go to some kind of supermarket in town and to go simply go grocery shopping. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. The rest of humanity is sleeping, and show people are out doing their thing.
Sure.
And I go into an aisle, and I look down the aisle, and I see a guy, a small guy in a cowboy hat, and I'm doing looking and look over it again. And where have I seen this silhouette before?
Uh-huh.
And I realize, okay, it's a black gentleman in a, and I'm. It's Sammy Davis. Sammy Davis Jr. is out getting like cold medication because I'm going can't. And he looks at, because I'm burning him. I'm like,
sure,
I'm being
staring.
A pain. I'm not going up to him and molesting him in any way or asking for autographs. But he's obvious that there's someone who obviously recognized, you know.
Yeah.
And I simply go, just, you know, hey, how you doing? And
he waved back.
Yeah, yeah. Like, oh yeah, like, and almost like, oh yeah, and thanks for not bothering me.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Because
I'm sure he's just out like, let me get some stuff and get back home, and then just, you know.
That's why I'm out this time.
Because they're people. You know, they're people like everyone else.
They need.
They put their cowboy hat on and gold diamond rings on, just like everyone else.
Yeah, all the jewelry. That's right.
So anyway.
Yeah, can you imagine Mr. T at the 7-Eleven at 3 in the morning?
Yeah, right. Exactly right.
Take him 2 hours to get all that stuff on.
But that's, to me, that was the beauty of this, of my time coming to Vegas in the 80s, and it was fun. It's still fun. It ain't the same, but it's a little amazing.
Was Richie Arty also intense backstage and getting things ready?
During the day, we got along great. We had a bromance, I think.
Okay.
We get along great. I auditioned for his show. As I mentioned earlier, I go to Tannen's. Hey, Ricciardi is looking for an actor, having an audition. Oh, there's a Greek club called the Scirocco Club in New York.
Okay.
That's where they're having an audition. Okay, I'll go. Okay. I call whoever I got to call. I think it was his manager, Elias Dishi. Elias Dishi was his Israeli manager who had an office in New York, who was a character all unto himself. Fantastic, crazy, maniac, fun man, but intense arguments. I learned this later. Would have intense. So you have this lovely Israeli intense guy who, and you had this hot-blooded Peruvian magician guy, and they would sometimes be at each other's throats, battling with each other over God knows what. But in their each languages, and then be cursing in multiple languages at each other. It was just hilarious. But Aldo loved him. Amazingly talented performer. During the day, you'd go to lunch or go get a coffee or whatever in the morning, and he'd be hilarious sharing road stories or other things going on.
Very down-to-earth, regular kind of a guy.
Yes. Traveling to Tehran. But, you know, and I have such a respect and admiration for performers such as him, Marvin Roy, all of the greats that we know now. We're traveling back in the 40s, flying to another country. You're literally in a flying station wagon. I mean, the aircraft then...
Compared to now, there is no comparison.
Yeah, they're correct. That's why I relate it to. It's like your dad's station wagon with wings.
Yeah.
And I go, God bless them. I mean, talk about on the road.
Yeah.
Amazing. During the day, he'd be absolutely fine. He'd be a lovely man. As it got closer to showtime...
Yeah,
he became the Mr. Hyde,
a different character.
Yes,
completely.
And when he got to the theater, and as it got now, I tried to in my intelligent college diploma like way do an amateur analysis of this. It wasn't butterflies. I don't believe it. And I'm thinking he can't be afraid to perform at this point, because when I was working with him, he's in his 60s, I believe. You would never know it by his physicality and his ability. But and he it seemed to become he became more like a caged animal.
Maybe it's just attention to detail to make sure everything was perfect in its right place.
Yeah, so. And again, here's a gentleman, if you see video of him, where he's depending on other humans all the time,
sure.
The assistants. Now, Ricardo, his son, Rena was his daughter, but there was usually another female assistant, another male assistant, who was not family. And although these people were trained, there was no knowing whether or not these people were going to be as sharp as the rest of the gang in
okay,
the show.
Okay, makes sense.
So maybe there was that fear or trepidation of, you know, something's going to go wrong or something can go wrong. I don't know. But you would think after, you know, it's one of those things for me, having now done a big giant monster show of my own over time, that if someone does something wrong, like goofs up or makes a mistake, I blame myself. Yelling at somebody backstage doesn't help anything. Right. Yelling at a performer or tech people doesn't help anyone. Because unless you're thinking you're going to fire that person, there's nothing, none of that, even if that's going to happen, why yell and scream? It doesn't solve it because you have to get to the problem and solve it. So after you're done having your little tirade or your little personal exponential anger management display, you've got to get back to reality and solve the issue.
That's right.
That's why a lot of the times when a show is going on and I see people freaking out, I always say, well, first you freak out. I said, how about this? How about you skip the freak out part and
go
get
direct
to the solution?
Yeah.
How do we solve this? You know, this has happened countless times in countless shows. That's live show business. That's what happens.
That's what happens.
He would get to be very tense and tight and it, some days worse than others. Some days he'd be goofing around and fun right before the show.
Yeah.
Like he'd be in his tux, curtain about to go up, and he's doing shtick and he's doing gags.
It's funny.
Yeah. For me, it was like going to school, watching, because I'm now not watching it from the front, which was always fantastic, but watching it from the wings in Atlantic City when we were in a boardwalk theater and it was like a small 300-seat cabaret. And he's doing, you know, the brooms and the Dakota chair and all the big illusions in this small space. So I'm literally not 15 feet from him when I'm standing
right
in the wings.
Different perspective also.
Yeah, my God, yes. And Ricciardi's College of Magical Knowledge. It was like, what makes him this person? How has he become this icon of amazing performance, mm-hmm, that when you ask David Copperfield or anybody who is of any ilk in the business who their favorite, they all mention Ricciardi.
Yeah.
It's just and here I am working with him, and I had the pleasure of calling him friend and hanging out with him, you know, after shows, going to dinner.
For how many years?
Like I said, over a two-year period, probably a year total.
Okay.
I wish it was longer, but that's just the way the business is sometimes.
Yeah.
You do, for example, I was at City Lights at the Flamingo for like 9 years, and I rarely see any of the performers.
Really? You just kind of do your thing, go back to the dressing room, and then leave?
Nino, Freddy, well, I rarely see it. Now that the show's been over for a while, I rarely see any performers. You know, we all see each other when we get to work. Now the show isn't running. I don't see them in town. And so why would I not run into one of those humans?
Sure.
There was like 60 people in the show, stagehands. Now, when someone dies, everyone has a memorial. And I go, why do we show up and see each other?
Celebrate their life while they're living.
But why don't we get together like every year and just hang out and go to a bar or whatever or a picnic or whatever? Why do we have to meet when somebody's gone? That, you know, someone who we laughed with and loved.
And then at those services, you probably say, we need to get together, and then you don't.
And you don't. No.
Yeah.
That's
too bad.
Maybe it's just humans. You know, we have our own song and dance we do.
It's
and that's
not just magicians or show people.
Correct.
It's just
the way
humans are.
Yes.
We're talking about your art also, and you have some beautiful artwork you do, and you've got some new things you have been doing with spelling of the names of Houdini and Cardini and some others. You want to talk a little bit about?
When I visited Stan Allen's office, he had this beautiful framed artwork behind him on the wall of Ricciardi Jr.'s name done in playing cards.
Yeah.
The letters of the name are formed in playing cards. And when I saw it, because I worked with Ricciardi, of course I'm drawn to it. I had no idea this piece of artwork existed.
Mm.
I've learned since there were five of them on Earth.
Of that particular poster?
Apparently so.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
And Stan is one of the people who have it. I think David has one, David Copperfield. I don't know who else has the others. But in any case, I saw it and I went, wow, that's really beautiful. But in my artist brain, I went, I think I could do better than
replicate
this.
Or,
I think I could do this
better.
Better. I think it'd make it. Because there's some perspective things and details about it that I went, you know, it's just because being into artwork, I knew my capability or what I'm.
Right.
Because of not only that, a lot of the training I had in college was doing diagrams, doing like you the
like mechanical
illustration. You do have a padlock, and you would draw that padlock exactly as you would see it from the front, from the side, from the bottom, from the top,
right?
In all the dimensions, and you're literally measuring the object. Mm-hmm. So your drawing is life size.
That's just wondering if today you use CAD drawings in order to kind of make.
I wish I could, and so, I probably should find a friend who who's a great computer person.
Okay.
All of what you've seen of these card paintings I've done, and so I started doing Houdini because I thought, who doesn't like Harry? Yeah. And then realized, oh, let me do all the boys that we all know and love. So I did Dante and Cardini, and then realized as I was doing Cardini, hey, wouldn't it be cool, aside from their name being done in cards, to add something in the painting that
is iconic for them?
Yes, identifies them, or is a little something from their act, something that we all magicians know,
like handcuffs for Houdini, for example.
Exactly right. Which after I finished it, I realized I could have done handcuffs for Houdini. So then one of the next ones, I'll do another Houdini and do exactly that. So Dante, on the top of the T, I have a devil reclining, holding a ball of fire. And I realized, wow, all of us have such admiration for these people that we've never known.
Yeah.
No, we read about them. We read about their exploits in magazines or books. In fact, Walter B. Gibson, that's what got me involved in magic at 9 years old. I found Walter B. Gibson's book, Famous Magicians and Their Greatest Tricks or something. That was the mm-hmm. book. And reading about Dante having two shows that sank to the bottom of the ocean and rebuilding it and still continuing to perform, just and all of the stuff with Houdini and Blackstone. And so I decided I was going to do all the people we know and then some.
Yeah.
And I knew some guys would possibly enjoy having their own name done.
Yeah.
So
you do that also?
Yes.
I started doing
that when show business stopped.
Yeah.
You know, for a year. It kept me busy. So I would be working on new magic stuff because that happens irrespective of anything else in my brain. Mm-hmm. At least for me, I'm always creating new stuff, always pushing the envelope, or ideas that I've had in my head for years that I haven't quite solved yet. You know, I've discussed it with Jim Steinmeier. I love it, but it's not quite what I can't quite get to.
That's your artist brain. It's never perfect.
Yeah, and so you're always pushing it. And
I was talking to Michael Goddard here in town, and did a podcast episode with him. And the reason I was talking with him was to find out specifically what is it about an artist, that is a graphic artist in his case, and also he does some sculpture, mainly a graphic artist, painting and everything, and relating that then to a performance artist, so about creating different kinds of things like that. And it was very interesting. And I was saying, whereas a magician can perform some art and then they can perform it again saying, well, I'm going to do this a little bit differently. I'm going to stand this way. I'm going to use this line or whatever.
Yeah.
But when it comes to art, have you ever seen something on someone's wall or in a museum and said, I wish I could, or I'd like to just kind of take my brush and add something to that?
Absolutely.
And he said, I absolutely do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it's a natural thing. Not only that, you see something and you go, you say to yourself, how would I do that? Or, you know, how would I approach this? Or at times, which much like watching magicians, and I related to that, you'll see something and they'll fool you, which is why we do this, I think. Mm-hmm. So we still see people that fool us, and you go, and it's funny, when I get fooled, I laugh. I just find
we do naturally. I think it's a natural.
I just think it tickles me and it tweaks. It hits that nerve in my brain where I laugh, and it's that whimsical thing that happens in your head. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with some artwork. I don't look at it and go and laugh, but I look at it and go, wow, that's a really clever idea.
Yeah.
Like for example, I was at the convention. I was with Roger Dreyer,
yeah,
Phantasma Magic, and he had happened to have with him, which I thought to myself, that's an interesting thing to bring to a magic convention, two cells from an animated film of Snoopy.
Okay, not Fantasia.
No,
or something would be okay.
Yeah, and it's one of and but see, I that's one of the things I can see a Snoopy. Mm-hmm. drawing or Snoopy dressed like a magician,
yeah,
that Charles Schulz did, and it just tickles me. It just what is that iconic character? Why does it do that to us?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's fun. It's and that's why it's so successful. Like Garfield the cat, the same thing. It's like, yeah, what is it about that you go, oh, that's adorable, that's cute, that's sweet. You know, something about it that makes you go, Wow. So anyway, it's one of those things. But well, but it's just like and also I see artwork where I go, how do they do that technique? How do they accomplish that? How do they make it look three dimensional? How do they, you know,
sure?
So you push the envelope.
I had a minor in radio and television, and also looking at television at the time, we were tasked with like watching a half hour show, a sitcom, or whatever it happened to be, and then say, why are they doing this shot? Why are they doing a two shot, a one shot, or a group shot? Why are they showing this with some room over this person's shoulder? Is it anticipating something going to be happening? And you learn film techniques, and so you learn to watch things from a different perspective when you're doing that. The same thing. I actually was in art school. I started out as an artist and then changed to journalism, but also learning some techniques of art and what to look for. And I have an artist's eye for composition whenever I take photographs. I'm very particular about that.
It's interesting. This young gentleman I was talking with, 15-year-old, is about to do, loves card tricks. I said, hey, you don't have to do giant illusions. You don't have, I don't know, no one, but I didn't start. I couldn't afford to big illusions. We all start with the deck of cards.
Deck of cards.
Coins, rope, string. Mm-hmm. You know, you do what you do, stuff you find around the house. But I was telling him, take acting classes or read acting books. Anything, you know, it doesn't always have to be magic because there's so many elements to this. Any kind of performance book. I remember in college, a theater class, one of the teachers, all of them exceptional. There were four. The class was always 4 hours. One time a 4 hour stretch a week, and each teacher either took turns or broke it in half. And one of the teachers said, "Go home tonight and watch television, but turn off the sound."
Oh, uh-huh.
And you get such a different perspective on it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Because you become hyper aware of the camera and how it's looking at things and how people are moving or the choices are made. And it's also when you're studying film.
You have to learn to have that artist's eye and develop that artist's eye.
And it's also like watching it's like watching The Godfather and the choices Coppola made directing it, you know. It's all of those things. Or Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood. You know,
right.
Just the choices they make. And just that's where you go, oh, wow, why is this so much more impressive or a greater shot than something
which is
else.
Why magicians should watch other magicians then as well. And I have learned some good things by watching poor performers sometimes. I've gotten ideas saying, well, it's not that I don't want to do that, but it's kind of like, you know, I'll give you an example. I saw someone doing a close-up trick on stage, but they were using jumbo cards.
Yeah.
And it made me start thinking, huh, you can make some things large, which means you can also make some large things small. And then kind of it started me thinking about some other kinds of things.
Yeah, sometimes you watch, and we all have witnessed them, not so good shows.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they outright stink.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn what not to do as well.
Sure.
You know, and there's nothing. Sometimes you can, maybe they're doing one thing that's just really good, but everything else is kind of, for some reason, weak. But you also realize, why is it weak? Why is that not playing?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
But any kind of theater I found is always positive to watch from a performance standpoint.
Yep.
You know, it's just.
I agree.
And
you still working with a lot of doves and parrots? And how many parrots do you have currently at home?
Well, this past year I had my red parrot Keo is 33, and I just retired her,
mm-hmm.
so I don't know if I'll be having parrots anymore in my act, but doing the dove act still, and maybe I'll have a duck at the end. Or I've always been.
Where are you working? than now?
Oh, right now.
Or will you be?
Well, Jeff Hobson asked me to help reopen Marvin's Theater.
Marvin's again? Mm-hmm.
They wanted me to come back and open the castle.
At La Quinta?
La Quinta in Palm Springs. And Jack Goldfinger had called me to open the castle again. But they seemed to be wanting to pack it full of lots of folks. And I went, not yet.
Exactly.
I'll wait. I'll wait and go back some other time. But I'm,
I can see why you would be at Marvin's. You know, as we're sitting here and talking, I just feel like I'm talking to my friend Marvin again.
Ah.
You know, the way that you laugh and your look and the things that you have done, because the advice he'd always given to Murray and others is just to have an act that would play all over the world. And that doesn't mean necessarily a talking act, something that is going to.
I'll share a couple of things when people ask me about Marvin. And first of all, God bless him.
What a guy.
Yeah, amazing human. Never mind, just magician. But
you were the only person in the world. He would just be
absolutely
looking at you.
Absolutely. And, yeah. Absolutely. Just fantastic. I had the pleasure of opening Marvin's Magic Theater 2 years ago, September,
19.
And hanging out with him afterwards, mm-hmm. I built a Marvin marionette.
You built a Marvin marionette?
Yes, because I do marionettes as well.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Did you work with Scott Land or somebody?
No. I was a friend of Barclay Shaw.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And sure. Barclay, when
did he make his own?
Yes. Well, and when he was at Splash.
Yeah.
He and I were buddies. When I first, literally within the first couple of weeks, I met Barclay a year prior. I did a one-nighter convention in Santa Barbara in 83. Met Barclay, and very sweet, he said, I'm going to save a spot for you in Vegas. I had no connection to Vegas. I had nothing. I had no agent looking in Vegas.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, boom, I find myself not only in Vegas, but in Lido de Paris, one of the biggest shows, not only in Vegas, but in the world. I mean, this is world known, being in Paris, and it's in Paris still. And within 2 weeks of being in Vegas, I get a card backstage, Barclay Shaw. I'm in the audience. We became great friends. We'd hang out after shows, go for drinks, mm-hmm. to dinner. He was hilarious. You thought Clara Cluck is funny. Not only that, like hyper creative, was like had this monster addiction of getting heavily back into magic when I met him in his life.
Yeah, okay.
And that's he was at the time working on and coming to the conclusion of his Levitation. Where the girl undulates as she floats, instead of floating like an agate, where she's stiff as a rock, she looks like she's floating
actually
in water.
Actually, floating,
yeah. And which, and then the her floating into a plexiglass box, mm-hmm. and continuing to float inside the plexiglass box for during his levitation.
Yeah.
Which, when he passed away, David Copperfield bought and used both of those pieces of material. One for his water levitation, where the girl's floating on the fountain of water instead of floating
up
like a rock. And then when David flew, he had the plexiglass box he flew
that he was inside.
Oh. Yes, yes.
Interesting.
But his puppet work is phenomenal. Even other puppet people, jealous as they were, admired his ability and technique because he was the only one headlining in Vegas. I mean, when I met him, I saw him at a magic convention, Tandem Jubilee, when I was a teenager. Years later, flash forward 10 years, I'm now doing a one-nighter with the same exact person. I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah,
and I was like gushing when I met him. But then again, I was gushing when I met Peter Ravine and Marvin and Norm and Jack and Dove. And oh my God, I felt like
meeting
all
your heroes.
Oh my God, yes, absolutely. But when I got to know him and we were friends and would hang out at the shows and he'd be building magic apparatus in his workshop, he said to me, "I think you'd be really good at working with marionettes." Now I at the time was in town for less than a year.
Yeah.
Trying to see if I could make the Dove magic thing work, right. You know, because you never know what's going to happen in this town. When I went to see him at Splash, go back to the dressing room, and he hands me Toto. Now, the odd thing for me was I had never seen Toto or Clara just hanging on the wall.
Yeah.
Every time I had seen them, they were on stage and they were alive.
Yeah.
So it was very
surreal, almost,
disconcerting to see them hanging like dummies on the wall because I always saw them when they were alive.
Yeah.
And I use the word alive because when you saw his act, those were alive. There was no question in your head. So he hands, and it's like someone handing you a violin and saying, play this. Because it's spaghetti. I mean, there's lots of stuff, the strings. And he goes, oh, no, just hold it. And he put the feet on the floor and just pluck at the strings one at a time to see what that string does. And then he took it and showed me how to walk it. And then he handed it back to me, and he taught me how to walk Toto around the room.
Wow.
And I was like, wow. And now, dope that I am, that I take him up on his offer to teach me. No, I'm busy. What? It's like, I'm so sorry, Mr. Picasso. I will not. No, I'm far too busy to. It's like, right, oh, my God, what a dope. And unfortunately, a couple of years later, we lost him. But,
but you had made a marionette of Marvin? You're saying?
Yes, because what happened a couple of years later when I had then the wild idea of doing my own show, I went, Barkley passes away, and I said to myself, which had happened before in town, of an act that is really well known. For some reason, they retire, they quit, they leave, they die. Mm-hmm. And some other act that does that, comes to town, is now is that guy doing that, or woman.
Tribute show, maybe?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And no one did. Hmm. And I said, truly in my head, not knowing the amount of work that was involved, I said, I can't believe no one will ever see that clown routine with him blowing the balloon and floating away, or mm-hmm. sitting on the balloon and floating away. And I went, that's
kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. So I went about saying to myself, I'm going to see if I can do a tribute to Barkley by doing that routine. And then went about getting a puppet built by Renee Zendejas up in L.A. Renee opened for Sophie Tucker back in the day as a marionettist. But Barkley headlining at the Tropicana, at the Follies Bergere, headlining at Splash, the Riviera. And so I started doing Barkley's clown routine, and then said, okay, well, that's... But I then decided, oh, I've got to... And all of a sudden now I built a line of showgirls. I have a Liberace marionette with the rhinestone piano and car and lots of different characters. But when Marvin's Place was opening, Hobson calls me and says, hey, wouldn't it be great if...
Yeah.
I said, Jeff, I hate you for planting that seed in my head. Because, yes, it would be great. And I built Marvin and Carol.
Wow.
Yeah. And I can show you photos. But
I would like to see those so I can put them on the website.
I will email them to you. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I have a great shot of Marvin meeting Marvin. Marvin meeting mini Marvin.
Yes. How funny.
But let me share you the quotes. Marvin said to me when I first met him in L.A., I had the pleasure of going on tour to Canada with Chuck Jones.
Yes.
When he did the Fireman's Tour. Mm-hmm. Terry Seabrook and Chuck and Marvin Roy in the same bus. How is that for insane? Oh, my God.
Imagine.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
Because they've known each other forever.
Sure.
Amazingly wonderful people. As was Ray Pierce, who was on the tour, Jonathan Neil Brown, who's now Jonathan Neil.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Ogden was with us as well. Aside from Chuck Jones, Stacey Jones, his daughter was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. First met her.
Before the Majestics.
Oh, my goodness me. Oh, my goodness me. Just amazing. Anyway, Marvin says, Joseph, here's what I've always thought. Take your closer, whatever your closer is of your act, and open with it. Hmm. How would you follow it?
Wow, what good advice.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
it really makes you think.
Create.
If you're a close-up performer and you close with, you know, Out of This World or whatever it is that you think is your killer kicker, this is the thing that's going to get people, or you're a mentalist. It works for any form of magic. If take your closer, if you were to open with it, how would you follow it?
That goes back to, I think, what DiVerto was always saying, is that magicians stop thinking too soon.
Yeah.
And so if you start at thinking at the end, as mm-hmm. Marvin was saying, then
and the other thing you're taking it from there. This has happened to me. You create an act, whatever that act is. You've made choices of what goes first, second, third, or fourth, or whatever. And for some reason, over time, because maybe it's because you've had success with that act or whatever it may be, you believe that it's now written as the Ten Commandments. It's mm-hmm. embedded in the Holy Grail, and it can never
be changed.
Mm-hmm. And what I've realized over time, of course it can be changed. If you're the one that put those things in a row, you're the one that can change that order of things mm-hmm. in a row and mm-hmm. make it a different order.
Good point.
Or change it completely. Mm-hmm. I've always been waiting for the next Dove worker to come up the ranks and not have a parrot flying around the room at the end of his act. Mm-hmm. I find it very... I had the opportunity of, over the past couple of years, not being in a Las Vegas Review show, finally going over doing Cabaret du Monde over in Paris, going to Rome and doing 2 weeks over in Super Magic show there, where all the magicians, all the stage crew are magicians, all the crew, of the crew backstage in the house, the lighting, everyone knew my act, which is very sweet. I go to Malaysia to do a magic show for 4 months. All the stage crew are magicians. So for both of those shows specifically, Joseph, can you rehearse your act? And usually when I rehearse, they play my music, and I mime my act. All of my doves are invisible.
Yeah. Okay.
So I mime my act, and I just go through so everyone sees how I'm going to move. Spotlights know what I'm going to do. And I said the only difference is there'll be doves.
Sure.
You know, but everything else is the same.
Right, right.
Well, while I'm in Rome, all the stage crew are magicians. I'm in Malaysia, stage crew. I look in the wings, and it looks like a bad Tai Chi class. All of them are doing the movements of my act with me. Even the illusionist, when I was in Rome, said, I've watched your – and very sweet. I've watched your dove act 500 times. The older guys who had VHS tapes said that I broke the tape watching. But they're doing miming my act with me, and I'm going, get out of here.
Wow.
Flash forward, a couple of years ago, Steve Daly asked me to do Abracadabra. Uh-huh. And when you do Abracadabra, he has you do a lecture. He forces you at gunpoint. You got to do a lecture. And I had never done one before. And I begin by explaining, and I tell the magicians assembled, that the best way to understand the way I think and the way this all came to be is how I came up with the Dove Act and my choices and why. Mm-hmm. And I relate that story about going to France and Rome and Malaysia and traveling in these. And that was the first time during the lecture I start to cry. Because it dawned on me that, and I don't mind sharing that because that's a nice human thing. I found it very entertaining that the guys are coming up and they didn't know what to do. He's doing a lecture and I choked up. I couldn't talk.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm so sorry. Afterward, very sweet. A gentleman gets me a glass of water. I take a nice gulp and I give myself a few minutes. I'm used to being humiliated in front of an audience. It's perfectly fine.
Nothing new.
It's just another moment.
Yeah.
But I said, I'm so sorry. This is saying all of this. This is the first time I've said this all in a row.
Yeah.
This is the first time I'm talking about going to Malaysia, going to Rome, going to France, going to these
places. Your whole journey.
Going to Japan and realizing that this thing I created when I was 15 or 16 years old, that the magicians around the world know this. And I found it so humbling and heartwarming and amazing that it just got to me. And I was like, oh, my God. And I said, thank you very much for not leaving. Because it probably was a solid 5 minutes that I couldn't talk.
It was like,
talk.
You in spilling your soul.
Yeah, yeah. And also because it was the first time that my brain actually acknowledged that, you know, for me, going to Malaysia was 30 hours one way. So traveling, so you're dealing with the grunt work. You're in the process.
Yeah.
You don't have time to assimilate. And it was only at that moment when I said, oh, I'll talk. You know, I'm sort of formulating my little legal pad of information for Steve Daly of what I'm going to say. And I'll touch on Rome and traveling there and feeling privileged to have gone.
Yes.
But it was only when I listed all those places and all those magicians who knew my stuff, I'm going, oh. I kind of like had a moment. And it was very
like
beautiful.
Like seeing your own career.
Yes.
For a moment.
Yes.
Kind of like now I'm seeing what other people are seeing.
Yes.
Have seen.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad, very glad it happened because a number of guys came up to me after the lecture, and shared some of their stuff with me, which was very sweet. Mm-hmm. It was almost like a therapy class.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was going to say. It sounded like therapy.
And it was lovely, and it was funny. Also, when I started doing the lecture, and if I have the opportunity of doing it again, I will. I think the current president of the SAM was there, if I'm not mistaken.
Tom Gentile?
In Iowa, I believe so, president. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if, unless you're just president for a year, I don't know, because this was a couple years ago I did this. So I don't know how long you're president.
President, just 1 year.
Oh, 1 year. So one it's probably a different human now.
Yeah.
But I started by saying, and this I find this interesting, but people feel like guys in that four-letter word love, talk about cursing.
Yeah.
Don't curse on the mic, Joseph, I won't. But that four-letter word love that people have issues with. I started by saying, I love this. I've been doing it forever, but I love doing this magic stuff.
Sure.
It just, you know, it's one of those things. When I was a kid, I wanted to be Norman Rockwell before I found mm-hmm. my first mm-hmm. magic book. And after this, I said, I want to be a great magician. That was my thinking. Not good enough. But I read this book about famous magicians, and I said, I want to be one of those guys. That sounds amazing. That sounds fantastic. I didn't know it was going to be Dove Magic. That was going to – but when I found that thing, when I found Dove Magic, and that was the thing that electrified me. That's the thing that sent – electrical spark through my veins, and I went, that's what I want to do.
It was like from City Slickers when Curly says, there's one thing.
Yeah.
And that was the one thing for you. You just got to find whatever that
is. And when I've had the opportunity of doing talks for kids in school and things as well, and I said, it could have been a book on being an astronaut or plumbing or car repair. That it's that one thing that you go, wow, I love this. Mm-hmm. And guys don't often say that. I love being an accountant
yeah,
or whatever
it is.
If that's the thing that jazzes you during the time you're dancing on this earth, God bless you. You found it.
Yeah.
And that's
a lot
that's,
of people don't.
Yeah. And that's the thing. So the other thing I related was this beautiful thing that we found is with us all the time. It's not just this little hobby off to the side. It's been with me through the greatest times of my life, the lowest times of my life. Through, I'm talking personal tragedies, personal, you know, whatever.
Highs and lows.
Yeah. Highs and lows, divorces, people passing away, whatever. It's always there. It's that constant companion.
Yes.
And it's that thing that jazzes your veins and makes you go, wow, I love this, and I'm going to continue to do it and push this crazy, wonderful ride as much as we can.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's great.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. A lot of great stuff in there. Thank you very much, Joseph.
My pleasure.
This has just been, I feel like I've only been here 10 minutes. You know, it's just been amazing. Thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate it.
The last thing I always like to ask my guests, of course, since it is called the Magic Word Podcast, of what is your magic word? That is not a word, but a phrase. What is your philosophy?
Magic word?
Yeah, a philosophy of life. What is it you live by? Yeah.
Well,
what's important to you?
Something I just recently shared. I didn't see it, but Lance Rich did a talk at the
Collectors Expo.
Collectors Expo, yes. And we spoke. He was doing, I think it was a talk. From what I remember, he's saying to me about Las Vegas Magic Acts, or if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
or something like
mm-hmm.
this. Mm-hmm. And I shared a quote with him that what I wasn't meaning to, but as we were talking on the phone and him saying, hey, could I get some scans or some photos of you from City Lights or the Lido or the shows you've been in? And you know, and I said, we started talking about just generic stuff and life and magic and stuff. And he asked me about what it's like to, you know, when you're backstage, whether it's performing on The Tonight Show with Johnny and you hear that voice introducing you that all of us have grown up with, or when I perform for Reagan in the Ford's Theater in Washington, or any show, or an important
moment in your life,
moment or convention I've done, or just the daily doing the shows at the Flamingo or wherever, Caesars or wherever I've worked. And I said, he said, do you ever get nervous? I said, oh absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm absolutely terrified. I'm completely like, oh my God. But I said, it's terrified and thrilled at the same time. And I use both the terror and the thrill as an energy for the performance.
Yes.
I feel it's kind of channels me.
Mm-hmm.
As when I was younger, seeing Rich Giardi come out on stage and go, wow, who is that guy? That power, that energy. And I said, what I related to is like walking on a tightrope. Is it terrifying? Yeah, you look down and it's 20 stories down and it's terrifying. It's oh my God, you're you feel every molecule in your body. But if you take a moment and you take a deep breath and you look around and you just can appreciate the view from up there, it's just amazing.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. It's about being on the tightrope, being able to look
right
down and...
That's right, and go and just, yeah, it's terrifying. You look down and go, oh my... But when you look up and you see, you have the best view of anybody in the room, you know?
That's great.
Yeah.
Joseph, thanks again.
My pleasure.
This time has been invaluable for me, and I appreciate your friendship, and thanks for your words.
Thank you, Scott. It's great. Appreciate it. Glad we were able to do this finally.
We've been trying for so long. And so now I will say so long. It's over the Magic Word Podcast. That was Joseph Gabriel. This is Scotty Out. Wow. I'm just going to have to take a moment and take a breath. Boy, Joseph, thank you so very much. This is so much information and so many stories all packed into just a little over an hour there. It was amazing. Thank you, thank you, thank you for sharing everything that you did and for everything you are doing for the magic community as well. I hope everybody goes to themagicwordpodcast.com where they can take a look at the photos you had sent me. There were the pictures of Marvin and Carol, marionettes, as well as some examples of your artwork, which is phenomenal. But also, it was good advice there towards the end as well, is walking on a tightrope and enjoy the view while you're up there. Because as I mentioned in the first part of this podcast, I had just a very, very small view from there, I guess, when I was on the Las Vegas stage here this last week. And I, no comparison to you or anyone else who does this all the time, but just to have that little smidgen of a glimpse, I guess you would say, from that tightrope, and to kind of look around the room and see hundreds of people out there and being able to entertain these people who had come from all over the world to enjoy something. And it was interesting to just take a moment and enjoy the view. So, until next week, stay well, get booked, and use your terror and your thrill to focus your energy so that when you're on that tightrope, you will enjoy the view. This is Scotty Out.